Hello. Calling State Affairs to order at 1:07 p.m. Saturday, March 27th in the Max Grunberg Room. Today, we have three members present in the room, Representative Tarr, Representative Story, and myself, Chair Christ Tompkins. And on the line, we have Representative Klayman. So four members present. We have a quorum to conduct business. Excused today is Representative Vance, and unexcused today is Representative Kospin, and unexcused today is Representative Eastman. But despite that, we're able to convene and conduct business. Great. Per usual, thanks to Sophia and House Records and Tom in the back of the room with LIO for facilitating today's meeting. And quick housekeeping item for the committee's reference. On Thursday, because of a extended session on the floor, we canceled our hearing on HB 103 and HB 106, both governor's bills, and we will bring those bills up next week for further consideration. So on today's agenda, we have two pieces of legislation, a sponsor substitute for House Bill 5 relating to sexual assault and the definition of consent from Representative Tarr. And then we have a second hearing on House Bill 55 relating to defined benefits for peace officers and firefighters. My intent today is for to split the hearing 1 hour and 1 hour approximately, and we can roll over a little bit past 3 o'clock given the starting time. And for House Bill 5, give Representative Tarr sort of full latitude to present the legislation and allow invited testimony to present and get on the record. And then for House Bill 5, we'll continue with invited testimony that we didn't have time for, I think it was two Saturdays ago, from Paul Miranda and Tom Westcott with the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association. So with that, takes us to House Bill 5. Representative Tarr and Mr. Kelly, welcome. And at your leisure, please put yourself on record and introduce the bill.
Thank you so much. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Representative Garantar. I represent District 19 in Anchorage.
Hello, and I am Alexander Kelly, working with Representative Garantar.
Thank you. And I want to start by thanking Alex for all of his really hard work in getting us prepared for today's committee hearing, and express our gratitude to all of you for this committee hearing. Very, very happy to be able to present this bill to you today. I wanted to start with just telling the story of how House Bill 5 was drafted. I have become a real fan of letting the ideas come to me, and that means that Alaskans have identified this as a problem, and they're coming to us, you know, as their elected officials to try and find a solution. This was first brought to my attention from Standing Together Against Rape, and you'll be able to hear from their amazing executive director today. And they knew firsthand from the work that they do, and they're a client, you know, based crisis intervention service, and they saw every day with the people that they served how this law was failing to achieve justice for Alaskans who'd been raped or sexually assaulted. And to put this in perspective, and just to sort of benchmark it, this law that we'll look at today was written about 40 years ago and hasn't been updated. And if you think about our change in thinking on these issues over those decades, it's high time that we update this. We have worked on this for 2 years, and that was really important to me because this is such an important topic. The way these issues impact people's lives, the diverse state that we have, the big communities, the small communities, the disproportionate impacts in some of our communities, the disproportionate impacts in our criminal justice system to different groups of people, the ongoing problem with missing and murdered Indigenous women. So for me, trying to get this right meant trying to do it really slowly and create a process, again, where there was a lot of input from people across Alaska. Through those statewide meetings, we had more than 100 Alaskans individually participate and provide feedback, and then we had other more directed work that we did, including expert interviews and feedback from the Department of Law that will be reflected in the sponsor substitute changes. And then we were able to also present at the statewide meeting of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and that's where all their shelter directors come together and review what's happened in the prior year and talk about problems. And so they know, again, firsthand, because they're seeing people come in as having experienced domestic violence and sexual assault. It was so important to me to get that feedback, and probably the most important thing and sort of a theme for today is trying to do more listening than talking. And what I really wanted to understand is, you know, what's happening in our communities, how are people feeling safe or unsafe, and how does this law impact that safety? And when we listened, you know, we really learned a lot. And I'm going to try to move pretty quickly today because I'm the least important person you're going to hear from today. The people that will come after me will tell them much more important stories of why this legislation is so important.
And Representative Tarr, I'm just going to interject quickly for the record that Representative Josephson is in the room, and also listening online is Representative Hannah.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. And the most important thing that came out of this for me was we asked every individual at every forum that we hosted or participated in, has consent ever been an issue for you? And without exception, every person said yes. And so it just underscored again to me the importance of working on this topic. And just, you know, in my own life, I would have said yes too. And just, I think it reflects sort of the lack of clarity on this topic and the inability to really, you know, speak comfortably about it, and the fact that we haven't all been educated about it. So again, just telling me how important it is to address this. So today, we don't actually define consent in Alaska statute. We define without consent. And so that should tell you a big part of the problem to start. And our definition, with or without resisting, is coerced by the use of force against a person or property, or bore by the express or implied threat of death, imminent physical injury, or kidnapping to be inflicted on anyone. What we have learned, and sort of this is, you know, for all of us to orient ourselves, we pass the law, but then, you know, the implementation is the next phase of it. And in the case of the criminal law, if you're going to have a jury trial, it means, you know, somebody has to be explained what these words mean. And what we've learned is that the way this gets explained is problematic. First, it's not an affirmative definition. Second, it suggests that there was a use of force, and that doesn't fully encapsulate all of the trauma responses. And then also, it places a burden more on the victim than on the defendant. So in trying to, you know, sort of start out of nowhere, you know, how do you pick a new definition? And so I wanted to look around the country and you know, see what are other states doing, what words have they picked. And I just picked a couple to show you here, Minnesota and Montana, but we looked at, you know, Arizona, we looked at California, we looked at Washington, we looked at Idaho, we looked on the East Coast, we looked at many, many different ones. And, you know, when you look at other states, you try to think of states that have some similarities. So in these two have some more rural parts of their state, indigenous populations. So there was some overlap there that made me more comfortable with some of thinking that, you know, there could be something good here. So you'll notice some things here. Words are overt actions, freely given, mention of people's, you know, social or sexual relationship, current or prior. In Montana, again, you see words or overt actions. I kind of underline some of the key points here. Freely given agreement. Again, you see current or previous dating or social or sexual relationship. So what we learn from doing that is, you know, you see themes in these modernized statute. An affirmative definition that includes these words, and they're all really important. You know, freely given, agreement, reversible, and that it suggests both words and actions. And we'll talk a little bit more about the trauma response. So our new definition, consent means a freely given, reversible agreement specific to the conduct at issue, period. Affirmative definition, freely given, reversible agreement specific to the conduct at issue. And this is one place where you would see a difference from the original version of the bill to the sponsor substitute at the recommendation of Department of Law to add a definition of freely given. Again, thinking, you know, how does this get described to a set of jurors who have to, you know, evaluate this? Or, you know, how does someone evaluate against the words that we use in our statute, the behavior that took place? And so freely given means agreement to cooperate in the act was positively expressed by word or action. And so, again, we cover the words in action. And then I want to try to move a little more quickly through the other sections, and I guess how I want to characterize this is that since it's our first hearing, what I want you to be doing is is, you know, thinking about these words we put in a bill, but more importantly, when we hear from the presenters, hearing the stories that were brought to me that are the reason these words are in a bill. Because what we have to do is sort of evaluate, you know, how do we address these things and prevent them from happening in our communities. So in sections 1 and 2, there is a new crime added, which is called rape by fraud. And I'm going to let Keely Olson tell the stories that brought these crimes to my attention. And these are placed in sexual assault 1 and sexual assault 2, sexual assault 1 for penetration, sexual assault 2 for contact. So those are a new sexual assault crime. And just like it's described there, suggests that someone sexually assaults someone by pretending to be someone else. In sections 3 and 4 are two new sections of sexual abuse of a minor statutes. Again, sexual abuse of a minor 1 for penetration, sexual abuse of a minor 2 for contact. And again, you're going to hear some stories of why this was brought to our attention. But right now, our law doesn't differentiate between, you know, a 16-year-old and a 30-year-old, or 16-year-old and a, you know, someone much more appropriately aged, maybe say 22 or 23. There's no sort of benchmark that says, okay, you know, this is such a significant age gap. You're completely in different social circles that this represents predatory behavior. And it's a lot similar to the kind of behavior you see in child abuse, where the individuals are grooming the young person. And this rubs up against our age of consent being 16. And so we didn't change the age of consent to 18. There's a whole lot of, you know, conversations we could have about that. We left it at 16. And if you change it to 18, then you also have to sort of, you know, think about high school relationships and relationships among young people, because we don't want to criminalize, you know, safe, healthy sexual relationships. But, you know, you're going to hear these stories. And unfortunately, there have been some in the news very recently. Our short-lived attorney general, and the story about Ed Sniffen, you know, and he, when he was a 27-year-old and having the sexual relationship with a 17-year-old. And, you know, in that case, it had previously been criminalized only because of his position of authority over that young person, but otherwise wouldn't. And we, unfortunately, had a former legislative staffer show up in the news. And in those articles, unfortunately, was quoted as having said, you know, I know the age of consent is 16, and so basically I can get away with this. You know, and this was a 27-year-old and a 16-year-old. So these are difficult conversations to have, and again, you'll hear some of these stories, but those are what those sections do. In Section 5, if I can point you to the bill, Section 6 is where the new definition of consent is, and what Section 5 does is then talk about the circumstances in which consent might be given. So an expression of lack of consent through words or conduct means there is no consent. Lack of verbal or physical resistance or submission resulting from the use of force, threat of force, or placing another person in fear may not constitute consent. A current or previous dating, social, or sexual relationship by itself, or the manner of dress of the person involved with the defendant in the conduct at issue may not constitute consent. In number 2, you'll see a change from the original version. The original version had language related to the mental state, but that's included already in statute under sexual assault 2. At the recommendation of the Department of Law, we removed that first part. So then the next part is the same language. A person cannot consent to force, causing or likely to cause death or serious physical injury, or to being rendered unconscious. You might notice a change there. In the previous version, we had used language that matched federal law that said grievous physical injury. Or grievous bodily harm, pardon me. In Alaska statute, we don't use those words. We use serious physical injury. So to be consistent with Alaska statute, that was changed. The next part, a person cannot consent while under threat or fear or under circumstances where the person is fraudulently made to believe that the sexual act serves a professional purpose. A definition was added here from the original version, and there are several conversations around this. The definition here, and actually it was just in the news in the last day, of a story where a medical provider at a college was sexually assaulting students who came to him for care. And,
USC?
Yeah, yes, in those examples. So that's the professional purpose that we're outlining here. And then, again, added the definition there at the recommendation of Department of Law for clarity, because, you know, there have been quite a few questions, you know, what does that mean? So that's hopefully a very good inclusion. The part that's missing in this number 2 is it previously had the rape by fraud language in there, but the rape by fraud language got moved into sections 1 and 2. And when we talked with Department of Law about that, and this is, you know, something I'm looking to discussions with the committee members to really evaluate, they felt it was more not so much about that in itself is a crime. That would be, you know, the crime of rape by fraud rather than it being a circumstance around consent. So at this time, we moved it into the sexual assault 1 and 2. And then number 3, lack of consent may be inferred based on the circumstances of the offense. The surrounding circumstances shall be considered in determining whether a person gave consent or whether a person did not resist or cease to resist only because of another person's actions. That, you know, we talk about that trauma response, and a big problem with the current definition, it suggests force being used, and so people really characterize that as a physical fight. They look for bruises and evidence of that. We know in the trauma response there's the fight, flight, or freeze. And so the freeze, someone may just not move. They may feel so unsafe they don't move. And that's not going to show up in the same way that you're thinking possibly with force. To quickly move through these sections 7, 8, and 9, I would say are more conforming language as it relates to places where consent definition shows up in other parts of statute. Section 10, for members here, this will be familiar, requires rape kits to be tested within 6 months. And that was what we didn't quite get a bill through for that before. Section 11 repeals old definitions. Section 12, the law applies to crimes committed after the effective date. And then Section 13, the effective date for the rape kit testing is pushed out at the recommendation of the crime lab to accommodate how long it would take for them to, you know, hire the staff, and then it's quite a lengthy process for staff to become FBI certified and have all the other certifications for them to do the DNA processing. So the way I want to end this is, you know, we really want two outcomes. Right now, we have a broken statute that means that people can harm individuals in our community and not have any consequence. And this means, you know, that we need to remove those people from the community. We need a strong law that will allow us to remove those people from the community so we can prevent them from causing harm to others. The other outcome, the long-term outcome, is that we want to educate Alaskans about consent to prevent the harm from happening. I take no pleasure in you know, thinking about putting more people in jail or in long prison sentences, you know, so it's not just about that for me, but we do have people who are causing significant harm, and we don't want people who are dangerous in our communities. And so there is an appropriate response there. But more importantly, for the future, and so these things stop happening, we really want to educate Alaskans. So we think HB 5 is the solution. This is in your packet. This is from just February 10th, a couple weeks ago. There was a multi-part series, and you'll get to hear from these amazing women from Nome. They say change the law to make prosecution for rape more possible, and they're talking about the law we're considering today. And they say, some said an outdated statute dealing with consent ensures most sexual assault cases won't result in convictions. Advocates and survivors say it's time for some of those laws to change. I would like to add that my name to that, so it says advocates, survivors, and lawmakers say it's time for that law to change. So as we transition to the end, I know I've taken as much time as I definitely can with the time we have today. I really hope that we'll be able to do a little more listening than talking, because we have these amazing presenters. And the questions we'll have to answer, what is the appropriate criminal justice system response based on the human suffering caused to the survivor? How much of a danger does this person pose to the community, and how long should they be removed from the community so they can no longer cause harm? And how much do we want to invest to improve public safety and reduce sexual assault in Alaska? So these are your amazing presenters. Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm deeply grateful to be able to present this bill today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tarr. And we will go in the order as listed on the slide. So first, an invited testimony, Lisa Elana in Nome, if you can hear us, please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lisa Elana, and I'm calling in from Nome with my colleague, Darlene Trigg, also here with me.
Welcome.
Thank you. So I just wanted to start by saying a heartfelt thanks to Representative Tarr for bringing this bill forward. It is long overdue, as many of us in rural Alaska, all over Alaska, have been saying for a long time. So we are very, very grateful that we have this chance to testify before this committee today. So as I said, my name is Lisa Ilana, and I'm Inupiaq. I'm a survivor myself and a family member to and friend to many survivors here in this area. And a couple years back, we started to get together just to provide each other support as survivors. And what became clear to us during those dinners that we came together for was that none of our cases were investigated by our local police department. So we proceeded to insert ourselves in positions of different commissions and boards as survivors to really spark this conversation around how we can provide support to our police department to improve those rates of being able to get those investigations done and provide them the training that they might need and provide some assistance in that way. But over the course of a couple of years of taking that approach, we found that there was a lot of resistance to that on the part of our city police department. So we took another route. We decided to bring this issue into a public forum before our city council. And that then kind of precipitated a cascade of events. It became clear then that 460 cases of sexual assault that were reported to the police department over the course of decades were not investigated at all. The police chief left the police force. The city manager left the left his position. And then we entered this new era of taking a look at this issue as a community and seeing how we can make things better. In the process as well, we figured out that in state law, the consent laws within our sexual assault laws were inadequate. And we were finding that many, many, many cases, nearly 100%, over 90% of those cases were not leading to conviction after being reported, even after the police department had begun to really do an effective job of investigating. So that's where we are now. So I would like to share just a few comments with you very briefly, and then Darlene's going to share as well, that this issue is very, very difficult. We acknowledge that. When you tell somebody that you've been a victim of sexual assault, it's a very difficult thing. It results in often that these cases being reported to law enforcement, and then that sets off a whole set of events to where you have to, as a victim, if the system is responsive, you are entering into a legal process that's going to be very, very re-traumatizing. And the fears associated with reporting bear an awful lot of weight on a victim's decision to report. We have to keep that in mind. So rates of reporting are probably low. We know that. So I just want to say, in closing, in my portion of comments here, because Darlene's going to talk as well, that this bill needs to pass. It provides a context for police to understand consent and investigate. It also provides a mechanism for the district attorneys to provide tools to hold perpetrators accountable. So those are my words to share with you today, and I'm very, very grateful for this chance to share time. I'd like to pass the remainder of my time to Darlene Trigg.
Thank you. And Ms. Trigg, please put yourself on record and go ahead and proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Darlene Trigg, and I'm a community advocate in Nome. I think one of the things that I'd like to share, and we were posed a question to kind of help provide context to the committee to understand why this bill is so important. And the question was, what is it like for women to live in a state that's not safe for them? And we actually, as we were gathering victims were gathering and they were telling their stories, they actually shared with us their experience. And the things that they said to us was that victims have lost faith in the police force and the criminal justice system, and that many victims have been assaulted more than once. And that leads to victims saying, why tell police when they're not going to do anything anyway? And that's a track record that victims experience. And as a result of that, what we end up seeing in our community in particular is that the current state of affairs is so poor that victims are often seen in our hospitals for suicide attempts and other self-destructive coping mechanisms because they don't have a place to be safe. So I want to take that question of what is it like to live in a state that's not safe for women and acknowledge that when we live in this society the way, with the laws as they are, it creates a culture of safety for perpetrators. And so to come back to the original question, from my perspective, I don't think that women actually know what it is to be safe because we have to have so many walls up. We have to have so many, we have to be aware. We have to do all of these things that quite frankly are unreasonable, that it holds us back from being community members that are productive and safe. And it really makes it challenging for us to define that word of safety. I don't think we actually know. So in closing, I would just like to express my appreciation for being allowed to share my perspective and to the work of Representative Parr and all those who have participated in putting this bill together. Kliana.
Thank you, Ms. Trigg, for your testimony and your time. Moving next in the queue with invited testimony, we have Keely Olson, Executive Director of Standing Together Against Rape Alaska. Ms. Olson, if you can hear us, please put yourself on record and proceed.
Hello, this is Keely Olson. I'm the Executive Director of STAR in Anchorage. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and the State Affairs Committee for inviting this testimony today. In 2018, STAR's Board of Directors formed a policy committee to help educate and inform the lawmakers about challenges in sexual assault statutes, informed by the lived experiences of survivors. Those policy priorities included updating the state's definition of consent, as many states were already doing. Given that Alaska has the highest rates of rape in the nation, it seems logical to provide law enforcement and prosecutors with more tools to effectively prosecute rape. The state's definition of without consent places the burden unnecessarily on the victim to prove there was a lack of consent, that force or threats were used. It also allows the state to try to prove the victim was incapacitated to the point of being unable to consent. In practice, this is a very high burden, leaving jurors fully expecting the victim to have sustained significant invisible injury, which is often not the case. As was explained by the bill sponsor, Representative Tarr, the trauma response, as we've grown to understand it, often causes a victim to freeze rather than fight or flee. But the statute doesn't account for a victim, saying crying nonstop throughout the assault and not fighting back. Also, STAR's policy priorities included urging the state to do more to protect minors aged 16 and 17 from targeted victimization. Offenders are often quoted as saying to police under questioning that 15-year-olds are fair game, they're legal, and maintaining that they consented and placing the burden on law enforcement to prove that they did not. These cases often include the offender proffering teens with alcohol and drugs to render them incapable of escape and less likely to report for fear of not being believed or worse, in some cases being charged with underage drinking when they do report. STAR receives numerous calls on its statewide sexual assault crisis line from parents seeking support and ways to help their teens who they learn have been manipulated into a relationship with a much older adult. In these cases, the parents are often powerless to order the adult to stay away from their child. Impressionable youth are often led to believe by a predatory adult that they are mature and special, driving a wedge between them and their family support. The parents clearly see the manipulation by the adult for what it is, but often the teen doesn't see it until much later. In Alaska, the state only protects teens from adult predatory behavior if the adult is in some form of authority position over the child. I feel we should be doing more to protect our youth, particularly during those formative years, rather than treating them as full-blown adults without the privileges of being one. A couple cases I also wanted to relay to you today involve the use of trickery or fraud to gain sexual gratification of an offender. In one case, a woman awoke to her husband spooning her from behind in bed. As was standard in their intimate relationship, she reached into the bedside drawer for a condom, which she provided to her husband over her shoulder without glancing back. They engaged in sexual relations. At some point during the encounter, to her horror, she realized the man in her bed was not her husband at all. In fact, it turns out he was a homeless man who snuck into her house through an unlocked door after her husband left for work early and climbed into her bed. It's not known and was never substantiated that he'd been stalking her and watching her for some time. As soon as she realized this man was a stranger, she jumped up and called the police. The suspect fled, but was later apprehended. Since he did not use force, he could not be held accountable for rape. I believe he was ultimately prosecuted for illegal entry to her home. Another case involves a young woman living with her fiancé and his family. Their room was in a dark basement. She was in bed one night when her fiancé entered. She called out his name and he answered affirmatively. They began engaging in sexual relations. At some point during the activity, she came to realize this was not in fact her partner, but rather his brother pretending to be him. She screamed, he fled, and she reported to law enforcement with the support of her fiancé. Although the state attempted prosecution, the offender was acquitted by a jury because the state could not show force was used in this case. These are only a couple of cases where fraud was an element used to induce consent. We don't know how frequent these cases occur because they are not able to, in most cases, be charged as sex offenses, so they remain invisible unless you've worked with the survivors in some capacity. I would like to thank the bill sponsor for her diligence and hard work in shaping this bill, and I would want to thank all of you for hearing the testimony and for the lovely testimony by Lisa Alana as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Olson, for your testimony. And I suppose after each testifier, we could sort of take pause in case there is a question or two before proceeding and allow each invited testifier to present their testimony uninterrupted. But Representative Story or Representative Klayman online, any questions?
I just wanted to comment and thank Lisa Alana and Darlene Trigg for sharing their experiences and stories. It really helps me understand more, but I realize it's a lot to share your story. And the advocacy that goes on for women, I'm very grateful for. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Thank you, Representative Story. We'll proceed, and next in the queue is Taylor Winston with Office of Victims Rights. If you can hear us, please go ahead and put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill today. My name is Taylor Winston. I'm currently the Chief Victims Advocate and Executive Director of the Alaska Office of Victims Rights, and have been in this role since 2012. I'm speaking to you today in support of the House bill as both the Executive Director of OVR and also as a former state prosecutor of sexual offenses. Really, to assist your understanding of my testimony today, I'd like to focus in on my experience and what I've saw as a prosecutor. I served as a state prosecutor for 13 years, 11 in the Anchorage area and 2 in Bethel. During those 13 years, I spent approximately 10 years with either my whole caseload or the vast majority of my caseload being sexual offenses. For six of my years, I supervised the sexual offense unit in the Anchorage DA's office, and in the role as supervisor, I screened virtually every sexual offense case that came into the Anchorage office during those 6 years. So I believe the amendments that are in this bill to the statutes, particularly SA1, SA2, SAM1, SAM2, and the consent definition, are very important and very long overdue. As a prosecutor, I saw quite a few cases in which these amendments were needed at the time. In reference, and you know, I can't echo the women's sentiments more that have already spoken, the victims and Ms. Olson, for what they've said. I won't reiterate all of that because their comments are certainly encapsulated in my experience. But with regards to the the SA 1 and 2 and sections 1 and 2 of the bill, this really does help close a loophole. While there might not be a significant number of cases, and as Ms. Olson indicated, it is hard to quantify exactly how many cases, how many victims would, be able to have justice with this change, in part because if it is reported, it may not go any farther than the investigative level, certainly because the statute doesn't cover it. It's a loophole. So closing that loophole will not only allow those who've been victimized already to have justice where they've been denied, but potentially will keep other victims from actually becoming victims. Information will get out and that protection will already be in the law. I had my own case as a prosecutor, which involved fraud. And I took it to trial, and it was prior to my supervisory role. I was handed the case. This was the first thing I questioned my supervisor about, was like, wait, look at the law. How does this fit? This isn't covered. Because she appears to consent to the sexual activity, but not consenting to the person who is doing the sexual activity with her. I was told, well, I think it works, basically. So I prepared the case and we went to trial. The victim had very compelling testimony. The defendant knew that she wouldn't have agreed to this sex had she known it was him. The scenario was set up where she did think it was her fiancé who lived in the same home with them. And the jury really struggled, and they ultimately acquitted, and she received no justice for being violated in the way she was violated, nothing at all. He wasn't given any deterrence. He basically learned that activity was okay. And they struggled with it because part of what we tried it on was in her incapacity, her unawareness of the sexual act, because she was asleep at the time it started and then it continued on. Where was that line? When was she aware? And then was she consenting just because she didn't not consent? So it was really a very sad case for the victim and the system all together, and it shouldn't have happened. This loophole shouldn't have been in the law, and that's what this bill hopes to cure. With regards to the sexual abuse of a minor in the first degree and the sexual abuse of a minor in the second degree reflected in sections 3 and 4, this is also very much needed and overdue. I saw a lot of cases, which I think Ms. Olson actually referred to some of the problems. It's while the law covers a 16 and 17-year-old when the perpetrator is in a position of authority, it does nothing for those kids when the person is not in a position of authority. And they're kids. They're still kids. Yes, we can talk about the age of consent, but the people who engage in sex with children who are more than 10 years older than are predators.
I saw it over and over and over, the types of things that these predators engage in to get close to these children. These are not people that are socializing, that are coming into regular contact to kind of just have a relationship bud out of normal interactions. These are people that seek out children and through various means and groom them. And it is a time in kids' lives, especially when they're in that mid-teen range. They're not adults. They're very vulnerable. They're physically, emotionally going through so many changes. There's the yearning to be treated like an adult, to have that independence. Yes, physically and emotionally, sometimes they're not there. Their brain hasn't fully formed. The judgment levels, they haven't had their life experience to be able to weigh all this. And because it's an older person, they tend to trust more than even with a person their own age. And when it comes to light how they've been used and abused by this older person, it has really devastating emotional effects. I've seen kids who have killed themselves because they've had these types of relationships. Certainly self-harm, cutting, and other destructive things like drug and alcohol abuse. It oftentimes wrenches a wedge between the family, or they're discarded by the family because of the behavior. The law says it's okay. And so the parents blame the child for what's happened, mm-hmm. when really the perpetrator needs to be held accountable for it. There were a number of cases I had in which there were these predators, and there wasn't anything in the law other than just sort of at the discretion of a judge to deem whether or not it was an aggravated situation with the 13 through 15-year-olds, an aggravated situation that might warrant a little bit higher sentence on the scale. But that is very dependent upon the judges, and oftentimes there wasn't any reflection of aggravation through the statutory aggravators. And so there wasn't really justice for the victim of the immense harm that was caused. I just want to also say that, you know, I think all of you on the committee understand the devastation that sexual offenses can have on the victims. But there really is this intense ripple effect that happens throughout not only the victim's life and forever. They're forever changed by these events. But their life, their family's life, their interactions with friends, their interactions with future significant others, it has an immense cost to the society as a whole on health and human services, on work productivity, on maybe even driving them into some sort of criminal behavior that could just worsen the situation for them and the community. It certainly is a time I think we need to identify these problems. And like was said, these laws are old, before the invention of the Internet, and the Internet has just made an easier way to be predatory for these offenders and to find the children who are vulnerable. Thank you for your time today. I will just say I think the consent sections are important too. The more clarity we can have for jurors, the better, and also the less that we require or put the burden on the victims, the better. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Winston, for the testimony. Questions from the committee? Representative Story or Representative Clayman, anytime, feel free to chime in.
Again, Rep. Story, for the record. What I appreciate the solutions and the urging of changing the law to make things more clear, because this is a priority of Alaskans to protect and stop sexual abuse and harm from happening. And this might be more of a question for the sponsor of the bill or anyone online, but I was pleased to hear other states have adopted this more affirmative consent. And I'm wondering if you have any ideas of how that has changed impacted this. People have been, the changes that we would like to see stopping sexual assault and predatory behavior.
Is there anyone online that wants to take that? Because I'll just quickly say, in working with Mr. Skidmore over at Department of Law, there's been a national review of consent laws, and there's been a lot of work happening nationally on this, but most of it's been pretty recent. And so the way I approached that question was, I don't want to adopt anything from another state that's causing problems or, you know, has been challenged in some way. And so, you know, that was really sort of top of mind, to not incorporate anybody's problems. And when we talked about that, it was, you know, sort of the response was, we're just a little too early into the adoption of the new laws in other states to, you know, sort of have, we just don't have a decade, for example, of cases that have happened under the new laws. But if there's anybody else online that wants to add, please weigh in.
Okay, sounds like that might be.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And let's maybe direct questions to specific testifiers, just sure. So that there's direction with the, but a good question and to have on the record. I had a couple of questions for
Mr. Chair. Sorry.
Representative Clayman, I think as you feel free to proceed.
Yeah, this is a question for Ms. Winston. Ms. Winston, you specifically referenced the real desire not to turn the trials into a focusing on the victim, and I fully support that. And I'm just wondering, when I'm looking at the definition of consent in the bill, does that definition potentially shift the focus more to the victim's history in terms of conduct that was consent in the past, and how that compares to consent or lack of consent in the trial that's being tried? And just wondering whether that definition may cause a greater focus on the victim than in the current law.
And what I meant by my comments is that it would.
And Ms. Winston, just we're sort of in a very audio reliant context. If you could just put yourself on the record before responding.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Clayman. This is Taylor Winston responding to your question. The shift, I think, would be to shifting the burden from the offender, from the victim. But in your question of how this might shift the focus, especially on past behavior of the victim in a trial setting, certainly there is a rape shield law, which if there were things beyond a certain period of time with the victim's behavior, would have to go through a judge to determine whether that was allowable to come into evidence. And then if it involved the same person and it had some recency, yes, it might come in, but also I would think that would be something that the prosecutor, at least my role as a prosecutor when I was doing these cases, would evaluate that in assessing the evidence we had to prove it and you know, what were all the components. So I will say it's very difficult sometimes to say that all cases are apples. Cases are really apples and oranges, because each case is its own individual case with its own set of facts, you know, its own offender, its own victim, and the level or quantity of evidence you have in a case. But certainly, yes, I mean, it could bring it in, but I don't think it would bring in or cause a greater focus on the victim's, you know, previous behavior than it already does. I don't think it would change that dynamic.
So,
Representative Clayman?
Mr. Chair?
Please proceed.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Winston, are you saying that in terms of the focus that often happens in sexual assault cases today, you're suggesting that this change is unlikely to change that focus in any significant way than under current law, or am I misunderstanding your testimony?
And once again, this is Taylor Winston responding. No, I don't mean it won't change the focus at all, because if the law or the definition of consent is different than it is today, which this, of course, changes the definition of consent, there would be less focus on certain aspects of a victim's behavior than currently, because it would fall, it wouldn't meet that definition at all, and it may actually be precluded completely from even argument. But what I'm saying is that in certain circumstances, the victim's prior behavior may come in because it, you know, it has some level of relevance to this argument about consent. There can still be arguments of consent. I mean, this definition change won't eliminate arguments about consent. It just makes it clearer and puts less onerous on the victim themselves about consent. So there'll still be those arguments. There'll still be things that will come in under relevancy, but it, I don't think it will make it worse for the victim. I do think it will much improve reporting, notice to offenders, teachings to people, and then clarity for prosecutors and juries and judges as to what is consent or not in this state.
And Mr. Chair, I had a couple of follow-up questions about Ms. Taylor's experience. I mean, not Ms. Taylor, Ms. Winston's experience as a prosecutor in terms of cases that she reviewed, if I may.
Maybe just one question, Representative Clayman, just watching time and that we have an additional testifier. But, you know, at a future hearing, I think we'll have the opportunity to get, you know, into the details, so to speak. And I'm sure we can have Ms. Winston back before us. But maybe one more question, Representative Clayman, feel free to proceed.
That'd be great. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Winston, we received some data from the Department of Law in a recent year when you were not with the Department of Law, that the percentage of declined sexual assault and sexual abuse cases statewide was running roughly 50% declined and about 50% taken for prosecution. During the time that you were in a both actively prosecuting and in a supervisory role statewide, was that 50% decline case rate consistent with what you were seeing when you were in that role?
And this is Taylor Winston. For clarification, you mean across all sex offenses or the ones just focused in related to this bill?
No, I think the 50% rate that we're hearing about is all sex offenses, and so I'm specifically wanting to see what your experience on as a sex crimes prosecutor was seeing the same kind of cases decline back when you were actively involved in that role, not specific to the cases in this bill.
Okay. Again, Taylor Winston, and forgive me, I don't have specific numbers for the period of time of 2004 to 2010 to definitively say what percentage it was, but I would say in my recollection of our prosecution pursuit, it wasn't quite that high. It would have probably been more like about 65 to 70% we took, and you know, the remainder percentage declined. Some areas were higher than others as far as declines. Oftentimes sexual abuse of minors cases are declined or were declined during my time, probably more often simply because of the nature of the evidence in those types of cases.
Thank you, Ms. Winston. And I just have a quick clarifying question before we proceed to our final invited testifier, Brian Hoskin. Ms. Winston, in speaking to the fraud-related provision in the legislation, you gave an example, and what I picked up is it was the same example that was described by Keeley Olson, the fiancé's brother, if I track correctly. And I just wanted to confirm that. Are we in the two pieces of invited testimony, was it that same case being referenced in both instances?
I haven't spoken with, this is Taylor Winston. I haven't spoken with Ms. Olson to sort of compare notes. It sounds very similar. It could be. I would say that my case, we were unable to charge sexual assault first degree for lack of consent because there wasn't a lack of consent that fit the definition. And the nature of the circumstances by which, you know, the sexual activity came about. The next place we could look was with the sexual assault second degree because it encapsulated somebody who is asleep or somebody who may have had an altered state, you know, because of alcohol or drugs or any number of that medications. And that statute fit better because, like I said, there was a period of time that she was asleep where it appeared the activity started because it was already being engaged in by the time she became aware of it, in my case. But it still didn't fit well because at that point that she became aware of, then it became the loophole for anything that happened after that moment of awareness, and where that moment of awareness was very difficult to ascertain because it's hard for a person to tell you when they're waking up from a sleep at what moment they're fully aware of everything going on around them. So
thank you Ms. Winston. Appreciate you making the time on a Saturday, and that'll take us to the last invited testifier today, Brian Hoskin with ASA and State Coordinator for Coaching Boys Into Men. And Mr. Hoskin, please go ahead and put yourself on record, and if possible to keep your testimony in the 5-minute or less range. I think that'll keep us on track today.
Will do. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee representatives. My name is Brian Hoskin, and I'm a former Anchorage School District Administrator with nearly 30 years experience overseeing comprehensive school, academics, and activity athletic programs. Since my retirement in 2017, I now fulfill the role of Student Services Director at the Alaska School Activities Association. My primary role is facilitating the Coaching Boys Into Men program, where we are in year two of a 5-year grant. Coaching Boys Into Men is an evidence-based, comprehensive violence prevention program designed to inspire coaches to teach their athletes about the importance of respect for themselves, respect for others, and respect in particular for women and girls. The program comes with strategies, scenarios, and resources needed to talk to boys specifically about healthy and respectful relationships, dating violence, sexual assault, and harassment. The program recognizes that sports have a tremendous influence in our culture and in the lives of young people. It is designed to utilize and leverage what we often refer to as social capital found with athletes. The principles of teamwork and fair play that are central to athletics make sports an ideal platform to teach healthy relationship skills. Coaching Boys Into Men builds strong teams and fosters healthy relationships among athletes and their peers while building trust and setting expectations for acceptable behaviors, defining abusive behaviors, and teaching healthy relationship skills, leveraging coaches' influence as role models to their athletes. What I do is I train coaches. I train coaches to teach a curriculum that is designed to be taught over a 12-week sports season where weekly mini training lessons are presented by the coach to the athletes. These weekly teaching sessions include things such as personal responsibility, insulting language, disrespectful behavior towards women and girls, digital disrespect, understanding consent. And this is where, in particular, I'm looking forward to further developing the definition of consent. Within our objectives, by defining consent, we discuss and respect personal boundaries around intimate and sexual activities to create healthy, safe relationships and situations. We refuse to use pressure, threats, or force in any physical or sexual encounter, and we actively oppose and prevent incidents of rape, sexual coercion, and assault. And I believe that House Bill 5 will further define and aid this particular teaching component. Some of the other components that we do cover is bragging about sexual reputation, when aggression crosses the line, and in particular what we kind of talked about there is just being aggressive on the court, on the ice, on the field, but being able to tailor that back to appropriate relationship behaviors. We also discussed that there's no excuse for relationship abuse, communicating boundaries, and modeling respect and promoting equality. Now, through ASAA, we have developed some program goals specifically for Alaska. What we want to do is continue to build on this Coaching Boys into Men foundations that were established originally in Southeast Alaska. That's where Coaching Boys into Men first was brought to our state. We want to extend Coaching Boys into Men's outreach into Alaska's rural villages, where basketball is huge, but so are incidents of domestic violence and abuse statistics, which are just extraordinary. We want to increase the number of trainings throughout Alaska by traveling to central hubs, making the program more accessible and culturally appropriate. We also want to align trainings with activity seasons. And in particular, my role is to establish and continue to foster direct communications with coaches throughout their season to monitor, evaluate, and provide assistance within the implementation of Coaching Boys into Men. So many of the topics that are incorporated in Coaching Boys into Men program and House Bill 5 mutually validate the need for a preventative educational component and accountability for perpetrators. House Bill 5's clarification and an affirmative definition of consent will certainly strengthen the scholastic elements of CBIM. So I look forward the opportunity to employ a passed House Bill 5 in coordination with the statewide implementation of Coaching Boys into Men to further educate our youth with the objective of eradicating violence towards women. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hoskin, and clocked in right at 5 minutes. That was remarkable. I just have a quick follow-up question. I'll allow Representative Story and Stories and Clayman, Representative Story and Clayman, if they have a quick question too. But where in Southeast Alaska did Coaching Boys into Men originate?
This is Brian Hoskin again, and Coaching Boys into Men actually the program actually was developed out of Sacramento, California, and has since gone nationwide. But it was Juno and Robert Casperson and Ann Rausch that implemented the program first in Alaska.
Thank you very much. See no other questions. Oh, Representative Story?
Yes, thank you. And we're very familiar with Coaching Boys into Men, and Juno, Thunder Mountain does it too. And then my question would basically be to anyone who could answer, but this understanding consent and how to the discussions that you're seeing in your communities now, how have you been helping to help the community see the changes that we feel would be, that I hear would be helpful today?
Lisa maybe would want to, I wonder if Lisa would want to answer that question. This is Representative Tarr.
Hello, Representative. Can you restate the question, please?
Sure. And as this bill is presented today, and we are beginning this discussion within our communities to help people understand consent, how have you been able to help your community understand the importance of the change that you're seeking?
Thank you, Representative. I would just like to say that the majority of the individuals that have experienced assault that I am aware of and that have been a part of this effort in bringing this concern forward, their experiences or people they know and their experiences were mostly related to having been assaulted while under the influence of alcohol or asleep, having been asleep. In that case, unfortunately, as our current state law reads, consent is implied or inferred even if you are asleep, which is very unfortunate. So we, as a group of individuals here in Nome, understanding how the law is written now is extremely frustrating for us because, as I said, the majority of the people that I have interacted with are frustrated because the majority of the assaults that we are aware of happening were under the influence of alcohol or incapacitation or being asleep. So if this bill were to pass and this freely given affirmative reversible agreement to the conduct, of course, this new definition of consent would then provide that context for the police really have a good understanding of what consent is as written in this new law and provide context for their investigations. It would also provide a much needed mechanism for our district attorneys to be able to provide them the tools they need in this new law and this new definition to hold perpetrators accountable. And forgive me if I'm not answering your question.
Thank you, Ms. Elena. I actually want to focus questions for Mr. Hoskin, and at this time we're a little bit over time budget, so I'm going to wrap up House Bill 5, but thank you, Representative Story, for the question, and there'll be ample opportunity for us to get deeper into the details. So thank you, Representative Tarr and Mr. Kelly, for the bill presentation, and at this time, 13 after the hour, we'll transition to House Bill 55.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Tarr. It's a numeric theme for the agenda today. And Representative Josephson, if you'd like to make any introductory comments as soon as we're able to transition, you're welcome to. And then we can bring up the invited testifiers as you wish.
Andy Josephson, House District 17, Midtown Anchorage. Mr. Chairman, a couple weeks ago we had our first hearing on House Bill 55. This would restore a public safety PERS benefit, a defined benefit, for the first time in 15 years to a segment of our workforce. It's a segment that makes a very strong case that due to a lack of pension opportunities in the state, we are spending hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars training people to be very effective at their jobs who then leave Alaska. And even in those instances where they stay, they have inadequate funds to enjoy a retirement in a reasonable way. There are six or seven main components of this bill. These workers would contribute a base of 8% in all circumstances to as their employee contribution to their own defined benefit. That could rise to 10% on command of the arm board. The total contribution would be 22% from the employer. That is comparable to identical, in fact, to tiers 3 and 4. Vesting would be 5 years. However, the worker would need to work 20 years and could not retire, that is, could not get the pension until they're 55. Also, to sort of make the plan more affordable, there's a high five averaging to look back on their salary. There is also a post-retirement pension adjustment that can be removed if the funding of the plan is less than 90%, and currently our pensions are not 90%, so the overall system is not at 90%. So that's a high number to begin with. The other savings are the five-year averaging, the fact that the base rate can rise to 10%, and the fact that there's no there's no full medical coverage. It's an HRA, which is 3% of the average purse salary. So this has been truth tested. It's been Monte Carlo'd, if I can use that word.
And you get a gold star.
And I think that it's an urgent bill for the reasons I spoke of at the outset. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Sorum-Virk if you have questions for her. We do have two of our leading public safety experts on the line ready to testify.
Thank you. Ms. Sorum-Virk, welcome.
Good morning, Chair Christ-Tompkins and members of the committee. Should we proceed with the presentation from Tom Westcott and Paul Miranda, or would you like me to address the question you sent me by email first?
Let's maybe start with invited testifiers, because I know we were truncated last time, and then maybe we can just sort of open it up at large, any question the committee has, including the one I sent by email. So if that suits both of you, we'll go to the invited testifiers.
And I'll be happy to click through the presentation for Mr. Miranda and Mr. Westcott.
Thank you, Ms. Sorum-Virk. And so Mr. Westcott and Mr. Miranda, just give the command when you like the slide to advance, and that will be facilitated here in the room. So looking at the agenda, looks like we have Mr. Miranda first. Mr. Miranda, welcome. Please put yourself on record and proceed with your testimony and the presentation as you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paul Miranda. I'm the president of the Alaska Professional Firefighters and an engineer with the Anchorage Fire Department at Station 14 in Northeast Anchorage. On the line with me, I have Tom Westcott, former president of the Alaska Professional Firefighters. I'll let him introduce himself if he would like.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Tom Westcott, I'm the former president of the Alaska Professional Firefighters, and I am just available, having worked on this for a very long time, to answer any questions should they arise.
Thank you. Welcome, both of you, and sounds like a dynamic duo. Mr. Miranda, proceed at your pace here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to first start by thanking the committee for your willingness to work on this important issue. It's an issue that's both important to the men and women serving Alaska in public safety jobs and also important to the state as it deals with serious budget issues and a desire to tackle public safety issues facing the state. So the purpose of my presentation today is to illustrate to the committee that Alaska is facing a public safety recruitment and retention crisis, and specifically that there's a real cost to maintaining the status quo. Next slide, please. So since Tier 4 became effective in 2006, we have seen several unintended consequences that are now very apparent for Alaska's public safety employees. We've seen recruitment difficulties in our public safety agencies, such as the Department of Public Safety with the troopers, also corrections and municipal fire and police departments across our state. Alaska can no longer compete with the lower 48 when attempting to recruit public safety employees. Police officers and paramedics are in high demand across the country, and we are at a clear disadvantage when compared to other states, when compared to what other states are offering for retirement benefits. You can't find a public safety retirement plan like Tier 4 anywhere else in the country. Communities across our state struggle to fill public safety positions, and Tier 4 is part of the reason. We've seen retention costs that impact all of our public safety agencies, and I will illustrate some of these costs in later slides. Dollars are crucial in our state, especially right now, and they're being siphoned off as we're being forced to deal with separations and a recruiting process that is made much more difficult by our benefit package. Once Alaska's agencies find an employee and invest time and money into them, there's a need to get a return on that investment. We also anticipate seeing increased workers' compensation costs as our agencies become staffed with an older workforce that lacks financial security to retire, and there are other unforeseen costs as well. Next slide, please. So this slide is examples of testimony from police and fire chiefs, essentially addressing the difficulties that are that they're having with recruitment currently. You can see, I'll let you read those quotes, but you can see a quote from APD Police Chief, Anchorage Police Chief Justin Dahl, Fairbanks Fire Chief, former Fairbanks Fire Chief Jim Stiers, and University Fire Department Chief up in Fairbanks, Doug Schrage, all talking about the difficulties that they're currently having with recruitment.
Mr. Miranda, excellent selection of that last quote. I think the Schrage family is well represented in the legislative context, especially recently.
Yes, sir. I think we can go to the next slide, please. So in this slide, there's examples of testimony from also public safety chiefs, again, and an independent consultant on the bottom there addressing the retention issues that we're seeing. You see a quote there from the Department of Public Safety Recruitment and Retention Plan Overview 2018 to 2023, talking about DPS's difficulties with retention and how a defined benefit retirement system has played into that, or lack of a defined benefit retirement system, rather. Again, another quote from the Anchorage Police Chief. And then at the bottom there, a third quote from an independent consultant that worked with Capital City Fire and Rescue in Juneau, talking about that as well. Additionally here, I would like to add that the state's own actuary assumes increased retention with House Bill 55. That's something that was discussed and came out in testimony last year with the team bill, House Bill 79 last year. Basically, management and labor are all in agreement here that recruitment and retention stresses that we're seeing now are certainly the current retirement system that we have plays a big factor in that. I think we can go to the next slide, please. So Tier 4 has been in place for about 15 years now, so we have not yet seen an individual work a full 20 to 25 year career in public safety and then try to retire. It's worth noting here that in Representative Josephson and Ms. Soren-Burke's presentation in the previous hearing, they had a slide discussing three independent looks from the Department of Administration, from an independent actuary, Mr. Plicfornia, and from the State Chief Investment Officer, Bob Mitchell, three independent looks as to what Tier 4 will actually provide in retirement for our public safety employees. And they all showed that most of Alaska's public safety employees will very likely not have enough money to retire, even after a 30-year career. And also, most of Alaska's public safety employees are not covered by Social Security, by that safety net. So essentially, running out of money means that they're out of money. The average hire age of a public safety employee is 31 years old. So this means that as our agencies become staffed with an older workforce that does not have the financial security to retire, we should expect to see increased workers' compensation costs due to the physical nature of the job and the likelihood illustrated here that older public safety employees get injured at much higher rates. And on this slide is some information from a recent study out of California talking about incidents of MSDs or musculoskeletal disorders, essentially showing that older firefighters get hurt at a much higher rate, more than double than younger firefighters, and often 10 times greater than that of private sector workers of the same age. and talking about the essentially the rigorous physical demands of the job, firefighters, police officers, public safety workers are more subject to these musculoskeletal injuries, especially in the later years, as smaller injuries tend to accumulate over their career. And additionally here, I think we have to consider more than just physical injuries. Individuals who have reached a point where they're not mentally ready to do the job anymore should have the ability to leave. And there are reasons why in the public safety line of work you see 20 and 25 year retirements across the country. The physical and mental tolls of the job build up over time, and we need people to be able to leave when it's their time to leave, not only for their sake personally, but for the good of the communities that they serve. And I think we can go to the next slide. So this slide just discusses, or just kind of notes some of the additional unforeseen costs, things like increased overtime due to inadequate staffing of departments, increased training costs, loss of operational capabilities due to the inability to fill positions, loss of experience and future leadership, and also kind of because of all of that combined, a rise in stress levels in the organization. Next slide, please. So all of these recruitment and retention difficulties, things that I've mentioned, highlighted by DPS, Department of Corrections, municipal fire and police chiefs from across the state, these are all occurring with about 40 to 50% of our workforce still in a defined benefit DB system. Tier 4 currently makes up about 50 to 60% of our public safety workforce right now. So we should expect to see these problems be magnified as more of our public safety workforce transitions into this Tier 4 system and those in the previous DB system retire. And that last bullet point there, 100% portable public safety workforce is a frightening thought for chief officers across the state. We have, you know, as we continue to go along with our current retirement system, we have more and more of our public safety workforce that, you know, will have the ability to go ahead and leave at any point in time. Next slide, please. So there are about 3,400 public safety employees in the state of Alaska. These are the employees that House Bill 55 would be applicable to. And in the next few slides, we'll walk through a few examples of, like I mentioned before, kind of the fact that there's a real cost to maintaining the status quo, what we have now. And I used $120,000 as an average training cost for public safety employees. Some agencies report costs much higher than this for training. Agencies such as airport police and fire, for example, where the employees are trained as firefighters and also police officers, will have a higher training cost. But $120,000 is a safe estimate to use that's probably on the more conservative side.
Mr. Miranda, could you speak to the component costs of that $120,000 figure?
Mr. Chair, yes. For firefighters, that's things such as, not only recruitment, testing costs, putting on a testing and hiring process, and also training the employees to essentially do the job. Our police and fire academies, or police and fire departments, all have some form of a training academy where you know, for various periods of time where new employees are trained to do the job. For police departments, you have the police academy in Sitka that individuals get sent to. So that's kind of all, I guess that incorporates kind of all the initial training that would take someone to come, you know, off the street, if you will, and get them all the way to the point where they're able to respond as a firefighter or police officer. Does that answer your question, Mr. Chair?
In part, I'd be interested in more sort of granularity and sort of like cost component breakdown. But I think it's besides the point, and a lot of us are, I think, agree that retention is a problem. I'm curious sort of the price tag put on it a little bit, but I think we're good to proceed.
Sounds good, Mr. Chair, and I can get you some estimates or I guess a cost breakdown of some more specifics that kind of go into that number.
Thank you.
Okay, are we on the slide that says what is the fiscal note for maintaining the status quo? Yes.
We are, exactly.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so starting off here, the DPS and the Department of Corrections have testified previously to the legislature of currently experiencing non-retirement separations that are greater than 6%. So this would be folks that are leaving the department prior to a normal retirement age. And kind of like I mentioned before, this is at a time when Tier 4 makes up less than 60% of our total public safety workforce. So in the next three slides, we'll take a look at using that $120,000 average training cost. We'll take a look at what the costs are for losing 1%, 2%, and 3% of a Tier 4 public safety workforce every year. And again, that's using $120,000, not increased for inflation. And I think we're ready to go to the next slide. So this is just kind of a breakdown here of, you know, if we lost 1% of our public safety workforce every year, that would be about 34 employees. The training cost that year would be about $4 million. If you lost 1% for 5 years, your five-year cost would be almost $20.5 million, and then over a 20-year period, $81 million. I think we're ready for the next slide, please. And so you can see, you know, this is just magnified as more people leave. So if we lost 2% or 68 employees, that's about $8.1 million a year, five-year cost of $40.8 million, and a 20-year cost of $160 million. And next slide, please. And same thing here, with 3% of the workforce leaving, $12.2 million for a one-year cost, $61 million for a five-year cost, and almost $245 million as a 20-year cost with 3% of the workforce leaving. Next slide, please. So like I mentioned kind of before and some of the other things that I walked through, these monetary costs don't fully represent the problems that departments are currently experiencing from these non-retirement separations of our public safety employees. It's just one aspect. And these costs far outweigh the cost of House Bill 55, and even a 1% improvement in retention would more than pay for this bill. We've seen several examples from other jurisdictions across the country that have similar experience as us here in Alaska, places that have, you know, switched away from a defined benefit retirement system because of the problems that we saw when we made the switch, and have experienced the same type of things that we are experiencing now, seeing their public safety employees leave, lost training costs, neighboring jurisdictions kind of benefited from being able to hire employees who were already trained up, and then went ahead and switched back to defined benefit systems. There's Utah recently switched back, Palm Beach, Florida. There's several examples of places that have kind of had this same experience as us. And I think we can go to the final slide, please. So like I mentioned before, we, you know, labor and management are united in their support for House Bill 55, and we all have a shared interest in ensuring that quality public safety employees fill our ranks for all of our public safety agencies in the state. And adopting an adequate retirement plan with reasonable costs, fair benefits, and shared risk will help all of us in this mission. So again, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for your willingness to work on this issue, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Miranda. I have a number of questions, but I also don't want to dominate, but just a couple of just quick refreshers, and I know we got into the fiscal note of fiscal impact of the bill 2 weeks ago, but my memory has faded a little bit. The penultimate slide, I think, mentioned that the benefits outweigh the costs, and my recollection is that House Bill 55 and this effective Tier 5 system has been painstakingly crafted to be cost neutral, and that perhaps there's a de minimis cost. I can't quite remember, but Mr. Miranda or Ms. Sorenberg, Representative Josephson, could you refresh us what the cost of the legislation is, if any?
Representative Chair Christ-Tompkins, Elise Sorenberg for the record. The previous version of this bill, HB 79, the Division of Retirement and Benefits had an actuarial report done by their actuary, Buck. They estimated that it would be a $3.5 million annual cost, but it should be noted that that is because that would be less money paid toward the unfunded liability is what they are considering the cost. So in our plan, a slightly small amount more is paid directly to the employee's plan than is currently paid to the employee's plan. And so a little less would be paid to the unfunded liability.
I'm orienting myself.
And for the current version of the bill, the division hasn't conducted a new actuarial analysis yet, but they will be doing that as this goes to House Finance.
Okay. The part that's tripping me up conceptually is being paid to the unfunded liability, less is being paid to the unfunded liability. Right now in Tier 4, like I'm in Tier 4, is any of my compensation going to the unfunded liability? Like, help me understand how this differentiates from the status quo.
Absolutely. Again, Elise Thornburg for the record. Currently, employers pay the employee a certain percentage, and that goes to your retirement. And then they pay, so the employer cost is, sorry, there's some good charts that explain this a little better. So let me just flip to my cheat sheets here. So currently there is a law in Alaska that says, this was SB 125, which was adopted in 2008. Which sets employer contribution rates for TERS and PERS and makes it so that the ARM board calculates the total annual contributions required to maintain the plan's service liability each year. So
For example, the rate for PERS in Alaska this fiscal year was 30.85%. So currently under law, an employer contributes 22%. And then the state will make up for any difference if that's not a state employer.
We're talking about Tier 4 right now.
Yes.
Okay.
And basically what happens is if I'm a municipality, I will pay 22%. And then that 22% is divided between a chunk that's paid to you as the employee and a chunk that's paid into the retirement system that goes towards the unfunded liability. And then the state will supplement that a little bit. So does that make sense?
I think so. That actually, my understanding of Tier 4 and the defined contribution system, like by no means that sophisticated, but my understanding of Tier 4 is that every Tier 4 beneficiary just sort of had this like little lockbox retirement system, and the public sector pays into it and the employee pays into it, and it's just completely severed and removed from the defined benefit part of previous tiers. So what I'm surprised to hear is that for people who are in Tier 4, a part of their benefits are going to pay for the unfunded liability of people in Tiers 1 through 3.
And it should be noted that you know, your part that you're paying is not going towards the unfunded liability, only what the employer is paying is, and that's not just based on Tier 4. That's based on total payroll for all of the employees of the state or whatever employer.
And Ms. Sorenberg, so that contribution that's going to pay for the unfunded liability represented by Tiers 1 through 3, is that the $300-odd million, or it fluctuates a little bit, that the state pays every year?
Yes. In simple terms, yes. Yes.
Okay.
Sometimes the state has chosen to supplement that. There's been a few times.
The $3 billion in 2014. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I still don't understand how the state having to fulfill that obligation of paying down unfunded liability changes with the introduction of Tier 5, but I don't want to. I will sidebar with a sponsor after committee.
I think the easiest way to think of it is that 22% the employer is putting in. Currently, a smaller percentage is going to the Tier 4 employee of that 22% than would go to the Tier 5 employee. The employee under Tier 5 would receive 8%, or would receive, sorry, 10%, and 12% would go towards the unfunded liability. Or did I get that backwards?
Yeah.
Okay. Excuse me, 12% to the employee and 10% towards the unfunded liability under the new tier.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Story.
Yes, I was just going to share, Chair, that in, I'm not sure where the handout is in our packet, but there is a great pie graph of how that works. It's dated February 29th, 2020, and it's by Ms. Kathy Alia. Page 2.
That is actually, there is...
If I'm understanding it correctly, and I guess that's my question, is this what you're trying to describe?
Yes.
And Ms. Sorenberg, just as a note for the record, if you could identify yourself, especially when there's consecutive female voices, that will help us with the record. Thank you, Representative Story, for flagging that. Okay, well, great. We'll set that aside for now. I will, I'm sure, improve my understanding of this subject. Representative Story, Tar, also Representative Klayman, other questions? Representative Story.
I just wanted to comment that I know this is really needed to have a good retirement system in for all of our employees, actually. And I appreciate bringing this forward. And I was wondering, you had said that this is really comparable to other states, what they're offering. This package would be this new retirement system that we would be offering. You've compared it to some of the states that I know are retired firefighters who have left Alaska for a different retirement package.
Through the chair, Representative Story, I think Tom Westcott might be the best person to speak to that, but I know, for example, Washington is one of those states. But I think Mr. Westcott could expound more.
Mr. Westcott.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is Tom Westcott. Thank you for the question. When we talk about this plan and we compare it to other states, what I would say about this plan, number one, is it's a greatly reduced benefit from what Alaska had in the past. And then secondly, it was modeled after plans that are fully funded today. The most well-functioning plans in the country we looked at, and Washington State, as you mentioned, has one of those plans that's actually overfunded. And I guess that's a bad, they don't use that term, overfunded, because there's fluctuation in the market, but they're sitting in a very good position. Wisconsin is another state with a very successful retirement plan, and what we did is we stole their good ideas. We sat down and we said, how is it after .com, after the Great Recession, after all these market fluctuations, how are these plans still so well-funded with very reasonable employee and employer contribution rates? And we looked at what they did, and we said, well, these things make sense, and we incorporated them into this bill, and that's where you see things like the ability to raise the employees' rates, the ability to withhold the inflation proofing should the plan start to get behind a little bit. Those things help you get back to where you want to be, and you're not, the risk is shared. And it's unlike the old plan where the state of Alaska held all the risk.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, my understanding is that the Washington State plan proved so solvent that they reduced the age of retirement. Am I right about that, gentlemen, from 55 to 53?
Through the chair, this is Tom Westcott again. You're absolutely correct, Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Story.
Follow-up to that, I'm wondering the size of the employee group in Washington, if that had an effect in making the payments bigger so they could drop the payments. Does that make sense, just on scale?
Yes. Can we refer that to Mr. Westcott? There's going to be obviously more first responders in Washington State by a large measure. Can you answer that for Representative Story?
Mr. Westcott?
Mr. Chair, this is Tom Westcott again. I don't know that size, I think it's all relative size to contribution. Certainly their pool of public safety employees in their system is larger than Alaska's. But as we looked at plans, there's pension plans. Anchorage, back in the day, had the Anchorage Police and Fire Plan, and that was widely successful and really was ahead of its time. It closed down, but had very good experience and actually had some of these best practices in their plan. That's a smaller plan, is my point, because it was just Anchorage Police and Fire at the time. So you were probably looking under, 800 employees at the time. From what our actuary, there's plans that can have 100 people in them, and there's plans that can have hundreds of thousands of people in them when you're looking at places like California. What separates the good and the bad plans are those that make consistent, steady contributions in the good times as well as the bad times. What you see is a lot of states in the past maybe took off will reduce their payments in the good times, so the 90s, early 2000s, when things had gone so well. But I think what you have to be is steady and consistent over time. And I think even Alaska engaged in a bit of that from what we've looked at. So there's just a lot of best practices. So I don't think the size so much matters as long as you're engaging in sound practices and sound management of the plan.
Mr. Westcott, can you say a little bit more about Alaska having engaged in a little bit of that in the past?
Well, if you, and I think retirement benefits would be better able to speak to this, but if you look at the past contribution rates into PERS, there was a time where Alaska, early 2000s, thought that they were better funded maybe than they were. And so the rates fluctuate, and the employer contributions fluctuate, I should say. The employee contributions do not. But there are times where they went fairly low. So while they're high now, you did have a period of time where they were significantly lower. And they would be able to explain those rates and how they changed each year based on the information they had at the time. And one of the things we said we would do in this plan is we said, regardless, you know, if we are considered overfunded or fully funded, we are going to continue making those minimum contributions of 8 for the employee and 12 for the employer. They're very reasonable. When we built this plan, we looked at private sector. If you work at Providence Hospital, if you work at Alaska Airlines, in these places, and you have Social Security and a 6% match, and Alaska Airlines, we looked at flight attendants, they had some stock options. Their employers were paying about 15% towards retirement. When we looked at this a long time ago, you get a 6% match at Providence Hospital and 6% for Social Security. You're in that 12 range of what we're looking at. We looked for a very reasonable range with what you would see in the private sector. Currently, Tier 4 offers a 5% deposit from the employer in the retirement. And so for a firefighter who does not receive Social Security, there's nowhere else in the country that you can see something like that. It's and we've had discussions with people who implemented this bill 141 when it went in 2005, and they are open that this may not have been the best solution, and they recognize the issues that we've brought forward with the shortcomings of Tier 4, and especially directed towards public safety, where you have shorter careers that are based off physical and mental stresses that eventually require people to examine whether it is time to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Westcott. Representative Tarr, did you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I was just going to comment on that, having been a staff person during the transition to the Tier 4 system, and what happened during Governor Knowles' administration, the legislature and the leadership at that time had did this 5 years of budget cutting, so it was going to be $250 million over 5 years, and they short funded the retirement system because, like now, you know, there's accounting ways of cutting the budget and there's real ways of cutting the budget. And so my understanding is, you know, we had done the, like, sort of, we were funding the recommended amount. But then we backslid and used that as a way to, you know, sort of, at the time it was a way they cut the budget, but here are the long-term impacts of it. And so, anyhow, I just had that recollection, thought it might be worth sharing.
Thank you. So in effect, there was an unfunded liability that existed, and the state needed to pay down that unfunded liability, and the state elected not to. Although the unfunded liability existed because tiers 1 through 3 were not actuarially sound in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding. It was like the combination of the two, because you know, life expectancies hadn't been adjusted and healthcare costs hadn't been adjusted. And then the other whammy was then, you know, when we didn't fund it, and then, you know, you further go through any economic downturns, you know, then it exacerbates the problem and the experience of that. So I think a combination of things really led to why we had to, under Governor Parnell, do that very substantial deposit to try and catch up.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
And the actuarial, Andy Josephson, for the record, the actuarial negligence can't be understated or overstated. It's the settlement, according to Ledge Finance, was $500 million on that item alone. So, you know, we think that we, with our own actuary, with the state's actuary, with conservative triggers, we think that we've hit the sweet spot. And, you know, the other thing I wanted to note, and I've attended one of the meetings, is that these gentlemen and my predecessor, Representative Kopp, and now us, there is both sides, that is the division and the supporters of 55, the Division of Retirement and Benefits, are working together, right? So there's frequent communication, frequent phone calls, and certainly the state is very, very familiar with what this includes.
Thank you. And did you say, Representative Justice, that the actuarial negligence of tiers 1 through 3 can be overstated?
Well, what I was saying is that it was severe, we think that as Representative Tarr said, there was a lack of vigilance, and you know, and we took the advice of an actuary that failed us. And that's evidenced by the settlement.
Great. Okay. That sounds right. And I'm for one feel very reassured about what seems to be extremely aggressive diligence about this. And I have to say, there's just unbelievable intergenerational injustice between tiers 1 through 3 and my generation and those younger than me. The amount of money we spend to subsidize the negligence of tiers 1 through 3 every year could pay for pre-K and free college for every Alaskan, and that happens every year, and it just rankles me that there's such intergenerational injustice. But that is besides the point of this bill. But just to say that, at least for me, making sure that this is fully actuarially sound, which I have increasing confidence it is reassuring and very important that we don't do that onto future generations.
Right. And Mr. Chair, you know, fortunately, with the legislation Representative Tarr mentioned, we have sort of re-amortized that. It's still about $350 million a year, but we were up at $700 million. Mm. So the unfunded liability has come down from about $11 billion to about $6.5 billion.
Yeah. I'd love to have legislators who pass those. Well, I guess it's, you know, actuarial negligence and incompetence, but also imagine some wishful political thinking, which has really hurt the state and future generations. But Representative Story, a question.
This is Representative Story through the chair. I guess why I asked that question about the larger size is just I know that just having been this morning to the governor's work group on teacher retention and retirement, they don't have Social Security either, the new tier in 2006, and we're having a problem retaining our public employees across the state because of the new retirement system. So I was just wondering, and I guess you'd have to adjust the levers, but did you look into expanding it to all public employees?
To the chair and through the chair to Ms. Story, we're certainly aware of that and sympathetic to it. And we're aware that there's some evidence in a new report from 2 months ago that could be done with some degree of security. We think that because of the unique circumstances of this cohort and the fact that they're treated somewhat differently in code now, we talk about the tendency to suffer disabilities, and of course the other factor that makes them unique is this huge training cost borne by the state, right? So public school teachers, I'm a certified teacher as we speak, I have been for a long time, the training is borne mostly by the individual. So that's a big difference. And we also think that in a frank candid political way that this cohort will have more support, and that they can lead the way. And if the solvency is proven over, we hope, a short number of years, that the state, when we get our fiscal footing sounder, that an opportunity will be there to strike. And you'll see me supporting it, whether I'm working here or not.
Artfully phrased, Representative Justice. I have a quick question, if I may put myself in the queue. On the HRA component of Tier 5 embodied in House Bill 55, what's the analysis on how sustainable 3% set aside for health is relative to projections for cost of health care, especially accounting for the, you know, rapidly escalating projections with cost of health care?
I'm going to have Ms. Sorenberg answer, and I have to go to a subcommittee. I will say that this is a major give from the stakeholders, a major, major give, because they're aware of the cost and the unpredictability of it. And, you know, the retirees are going to have to actively find a solution because it's going to be inadequate. But I'll get this to Ms. Sorenberg.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us, Representative Josephson.
Chair Christ Tompkins, Elise Sornberg, for the record. I will have Paul Miranda touch on this as well, but I'll just start off by saying the HRA will act basically as a stopgap measure. It's the same as the Tier 4 HRA, the same as what you or I have, and it can be used to pay for medical expenses or to pay premiums. And it's based off of a 3% average PERS salary, which should be noted, the average PERS salary is significantly lower than the average public safety PERS salary. But I think Mr. Miranda might have done some back of the napkin calculations for his own future retirement, and he might be able to share those.
Mr. Miranda. Mr. Miranda, can you hear us? Might be on mute.
Mr. Chair.
Ah, there we go.
For the record, Paul Miranda. Sorry, I think I was muted there on my end. Yes, what Ms. Sorenberg and Representative Josephson just said is absolutely accurate. I think, you know, the explosion, if you will, in healthcare costs was, you know, one of the reasons that you know, you're discussing earlier factors that contributed to the unfunded liability of the previous tiers, and certainly the explosion in healthcare costs was one of those big factors. So, yes, with this bill, any pre-Medicare healthcare coverage is off the table. The medical is the same as Tier 4, and as Ms. Sorenberg mentioned, I did kind of do some rough calculations that the HRA, you know, kind of based on the current cost of pre-Medicare coverage, I think would cover, based on my rough calculation, somewhere between 3 to 5 years of medical premiums. So there will still be a gap for most individuals. But I think the important point is what this bill does is recognize that, you know, we don't want to have a situation where an unfunded liability is created, and a huge component of that is removing the pre-Medicare medical coverage that was in the previous DB tiers. And as employees, we can kind of look for ways to bridge that gap between retirement age and Medicare eligibility age, and the HRA will help with that, but it won't be a total solution.
Thank you, Mr. Miranda. Any final questions from the committee? Well, we're just a tad after the hour, so I think we did pretty well in terms of time budgeting. And I think we'll set aside the bill for now and bring it back before the committee. But I'm really glad we could get through the invited testimony today and start to get into a couple of questions, and look forward to bringing it back before the committee for a more detailed review. But thank you, Ms. Soren Burke. Thank you, Representative Josephson, and Abstentia, now doing his duty as Finance Subcommittee Chair. And let me just make a note that we're on a normal post-Finance Subcommittee schedule next week. So we'll have the full 2 hours. And we have a full schedule for Tuesday and Thursday as noticed. And then I think we'll be able to get to other bills previously heard in subsequent weeks and start to dig into work. So thank you, Sophia, who's online, as she always is, with House Records, and Tom in the back of the room, and our fearless committee aide, Jeff Stepp. And at 3:07 p.m., we are adjourned.